Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
These discussions with paramilitaries were at play with death.
Remarkable personal stories from around the world.
They don't speak with words, they speak with guns.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we're talking about South Africa's upcoming elections by looking back to that historic day 30 years ago when millions of voters chose Nelson Mandela as their first democratically elected president.
I got my finger inked, even though I was too young to vote, because I was desperate to, you know, to be part of the celebrations. But I remember the words that my mother told me on that day, that voting process for her, for the first time, she was 43 years old when she voted, and she felt empowered.
Also, 5 years after Sierra Leone declared a national emergency to deal with sexual violence, has any real progress been made?
Reported cases of sexual and gender-based violence has gone down by 17%, from just over 12,000 in 2018 to just above 10,000 in 2023. That's according to the police statistics.
And we meet Ibrahim Mahama, the Ghanaian artist who wraps buildings in tattered sacks and robes worn by chiefs. How does he do it and why? It's Monday, the 29th of April. First, we go to South Africa. 30 years ago today, voting ended in the first democratic elections in South Africa's history. It was an extraordinary moment because that vote ended decades of disenfranchisement, land dispossession, and the brutal regime of racial domination called apartheid. For the first time, the black majority, and I was one of them, was able to choose their leaders and dream of a better life for all. 3 decades later, and ahead of elections next month, South Africans have been weighing up whether the promises of democracy have been delivered. The path to this moment had been hard fought and hard won. Thousands of people died in the cause of freedom right up to that momentous day. White right-wingers, not prepared to cede power to the will of the majority, had begun a bombing campaign. Several people were killed in bomb blasts on the morning of the main voting day of April the 27th. The black opposition group Inkatha, under the leadership of Chief Mangosuthu Gacha Buthelezi, had been holding out for more power and threatened to pull out of those elections. With the support of the apartheid government, Inkatha had been killing innocent black South Africans to intimidate them in the lead-up to the vote. Those historic elections were on a knife edge. But finally, the day came.
Today is a day like no other before it. Today marks the dawn of our freedom.
Millions of us across South Africa lined up patiently in the April sun, joyfully waiting to vote for the first time in our lives.
I never had a chance to vote before, so today I voted. I think it's a happy day for me.
I'm very grateful. I'm excited. I want to look forward for the new South Africa.
Now, one other person who went to a polling station that day, even if she was too young to vote, was Nomsa Masego, our correspondent in Johannesburg. But Nomsa is in London now for a flying visit, so I'm very happy to welcome Nomsa to Focus on Africa.
It's good to be here.
This is your first visit to Focus on Africa, the podcast, and the pre-recorded radio program.
Yeah, well, it's good to be here. Lovely to see you all.
It's wonderful that you're here, Nomsa. What are your memories of that day?
Sure. I was 12 years old. We went to a polling station, which is opposite my mother's house. I got my finger inked, even though I was too young to vote, because I was desperate to, you know, to be part of the celebrations. But I remember the words that my mother told me on that day, that voting process for her, for the first time, she was 43 years old when she voted, and she felt empowered, you know, and I could see what it meant for her to be able to choose her own government. But that day was somewhat of nostalgia, honestly, because for the first time in a long time, I didn't feel like I needed to be looking over my shoulder. Whenever I see white policemen, you got to hide. Whenever, you know, there's stun grenades, there's just a police nyala moving past. But all of that was gone.
Yeah, I mean, I've shared some of my memories, but I remember stepping into that booth because I was working. That was my first stint at Focus. I was very calm because I was sort of slightly in work mode. Mm. But when I got into the booth, the silence of the booth and the moment to just think of all the people who had died to make this moment possible.
Yeah.
I thought of my grandfather. I thought of all my ancestors. I thought of my friends who had died, you know, in pursuance of this freedom.
Yeah.
And I remember making sure that Gacha Buthelezi's face, that was
the IFP, sticker right at the end,
was there.
Yeah.
Because if it wasn't there, my vote was going to be invalid because he had decided at the last moment to take part in the election. So that for me was crucial. And whenever I tell people that I checked to see that Mangosuthu Buthelezi's face was on there, they went, what do you mean? As if I was going to vote for him. I'm like, no.
I
was making sure that my vote counted.
Yeah.
Because that was what the message was on that day, that your vote counts and voting matters. 30 years later, Nomsa, do South Africans still feel the same way?
South Africans feel that they now need economic freedom. They feel that the honeymoon is over for the governing ANC, because even though things have changed, there are still a lot of disenfranchised people who still believe that they need to change the way they vote now because of promises made and not kept by the governing party. There is a lot of disillusionment, particularly because of youth unemployment, because of, you know, the high levels of crime. But there are positives in some regards, but people believe that this is possibly the last election where the ANC will hold a majority, even though it's still going to be a reduced majority, that they will have. They'll literally be hanging on by a thread. And that is why the ANC then needs to be shopping for good coalition partners.
There is one person in particular who captures quite a lot of what South Africans feel at the moment and the dilemmas that they're wrestling with concerning promises made, promises not kept, and the space in between. Tell me about Dr. Tez.
Dr. Tez was born in 1993, so just the year before South Africa became a democracy. She is in her family of the first graduate. She is a youth pregnancy advocate. She is a medical doctor, and she is unfortunately one of 800 qualified medical doctors who are unemployed. She is part of a group who have also been engaging in protests in major cities across the country because they want to serve as doctors, but because also South Africa's health system is crumbling. You have so many doctors who are not employed. So she is one of those who have been quite vocal about the plight of unemployed doctors and what it is that they want to do in the country, particularly in the government hospitals.
It's very disheartening because you grow up thinking, I'm going to be a doctor, I can serve my people. And then you're faced with the reality that says, yes, you're a doctor, but you can't serve your people.
There have been numerous protests by unemployed doctors. What is the feeling around this issue with your other unemployed colleagues?
I feel like everyone started with hope. If we make enough noise, people will listen. Now the hope has been eliminated. Now we have unemployed doctors sitting at home, disgruntled, feeling unappreciated, and that's pretty much the air that everyone finds themselves in, because it's April now. And since January, people have been applying for jobs, protesting, but yet we still have hundreds of unemployed doctors.
What does 30 years of democracy mean to you in this current situation?
I love that question. So 30 years of democracy for me has afforded me the opportunity to be a colored female medical doctor and the first generation medical doctor in my family. However, on the flip side, it's also highlighted a very sad reality in South Africa. The people of South Africa are in dire need of healthcare. Yet we have a collapsing healthcare system, and that's why we have 800 unemployed doctors. So 30 years of democracy, what that means for me is being robbed of opportunity and hope that was once promised to us.
That's a very powerful statement there. She grew up in the promised land, and whatever was promised to her, she did get, we should say. Mm-hmm. She got the opportunity to go to university. And I think I should mention, for the benefit of our listeners, she said she's colored there. Colored in South Africa means mixed heritage. And it's another way of being black in South Africa. It kind of shakes me to hear her say that, even though I know that that's how people feel. What I'm wondering, Nomsa, is how widespread is that feeling? And what impact do you think it will have on people going to vote? Will they go out and vote, or are they disillusioned with the process?
They are disillusioned with the process. However, there are people who will be casting what they call a protest vote, which will be a vote against the governing party. At the same time, there are those who will be lining up, queuing to vote, wearing their scrubs and graduation gowns with the hope that their vote is going to change the status quo because they want jobs. They are qualified, but they are still sitting at home. Others are saying that they want to ensure that the future generation, 30 years down the line, things are definitely going to change. So there is a lot of hope, even though there's disillusionment in some corners. I have spoken to people, particularly in Cliptown, who say that they're not going to vote because there have been promises that were made and not kept, and therefore they don't see the reason to vote. But it's quite encouraging to know that many South Africans in their majority still believe in the power of the ballot box.
The Cliptown that you referred to there is very significant, because the ANC's blueprint constitution was actually signed and adopted there.
Yeah, the Freedom Charter of 1955.
And
yeah.
It is also the birthplace of Mua.
Exactly. Cliptown is in Johannesburg. It's in Soweto, where people should not be struggling to get clean running water and proper sanitation. And yet 30 years down the line, there's portable toilets that line the streets that are hardly cleaned or even emptied.
Do you know, that's so different to what it was like when I grew up.
Hmm.
I can see a particular part of Cliptown where there were trees that lined that street.
Yeah. Union Street, is it?
Yeah. There were trees, not portable toilets.
Yeah.
Things have really, really changed. But let's hear what else Dr. Tass says about voting and why it matters to her.
Voting is the one thing that can recreate a sense of hope amongst us as South Africans. Voting was the one thing that instilled hope into South Africa, and it can still be that one thing that instills hope back into South Africa.
So that's Dr. Tass. For the rest of South Africa, what is at stake on May the 29th? In fact, it's exactly a month from now.
Actually, yeah. So it's no longer about the personalities, the celebrity politicians. It's about the bread and butter issues, the high cost of living, the unemployment, drugs that are ravaging the youth. It's also about the fact that the majority of South Africans are young people who are disillusioned, who want to see a change. There's also been the fact that there are so many new political parties formed by the younger generation in their 40s and 50s, with the hope that we're no longer going to be seeing pensioners in parliament. Because, they are the so-called sleepists, as the EFF calls them, when they fall asleep while parliament is in session. So hopefully things are going to change, and change for the better.
That's Nomsa Maseko. And Nomsa has made a documentary about South Africa's 30 years of democracy. And you can watch it on the BBC Africa YouTube channel. It's been 5 years since Sierra Leone's president, Julius Maada Bio, announced a state of emergency to try and stop sexual and gender-based violence. It began in February 2019 and came along with other measures like the revised Sexual Offences Act, which brought in stricter penalties for rape and sexual assault. A sexual offences model court was also introduced to fast-track justice for those affected. These measures have had an effect on the numbers of cases reported. They've gone down. But have things really changed? The journalist Tyson Conte of BBC Africa Eye has been investigating in Makeni, his hometown. We began by discussing why President Madabio took these drastic steps, and I must warn you that our conversation contains disturbing details.
Yes, the situation was spiraling out of control. The announcement by the president was followed after a protest in December 2018, where hundreds of women wearing white t-shirts with the writing "Hands off our girls" marched through the capital city of Freetown. At that time, news of another child rape, this time a 5-year-old girl who was left paralyzed from the waist down, had shocked the nation. Journalists were reporting at the time that cases of sexual violence had almost doubled within a year, a third involving children. Sierra Leoneans had had enough.
So what did it mean to declare a state of emergency?
Once the attention was focused on tackling sexual and gender-based violence, there were a lot of measures put in place. For example, the state of emergency was followed up with a sexual model court, which was set up to make sure they speed up cases of rape and penetration to young children. In addition to that, family support units of the police was empowered to be the body that was dealing with these sexual offenses, in making sure that they can arrest perpetrators and speedily go to court, and these violators can get sentenced, because that was one of the things that people think was a problem in trying to get a prosecution. The culture in Africa, most times the people who violate or who rape these women are actually family members or people in the community, and that a lot of compromise is almost always done. And as a result of the delays in the courts, most cases will just die down or left out because of frustration of the complainants. They become frustrated coming to police all the time or going to the courts. So when the state of emergency was set up, they followed it with the sexual model courts. This was intended to speed the investigations and prosecution.
I believe that there was a revised Sexual Offences Act as well, which brought in stricter penalties for rape and sexual assault, right?
Exactly. The revised sexual penalty was that the minimum of 15 years was labelled to anyone that was found guilty of rape. And one can go for a life imprisonment if the rape or the sexual penetration has to do with a child. You know, so that was also brought in just to make sure they cut down or curtail the spiraling actions of rape and sexual violence around the country that time.
So it's been 5 years since the state of emergency was declared. Has anything changed?
Well, yes. Things seems to improve a little when you look at the numbers. Even though when you talk to some people, they will tell you nothing has changed. But when you look at reports and numbers, things seems to be changing to the positive. For example, reported cases of sexual and gender-based violence has gone down by 17% from just over 12,000 in 2018 to just above 10,000 in 2023. That's according to the police statistics. But you think again, over 10,000 is still very high and it's still worrying.
Now, you've been doing a documentary on this for Africa Eye, and you spoke to people that are directly affected by it. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the people that you've met, specifically the woman whose child, whose infant, whose, you know, baby had been raped?
I talked to many other people, but the most shocking one was actually the one that has to do with the woman we are calling Anita, not her real name, with the 16-month-old baby that was raped and has to go through two surgeries at 18 months old to get her life back. That was so shocking, and it's really, really got my attention.
Anita, not her real name, is a mother in my hometown of Makeni. In June 2023, Anita worked for a woman. That woman's 22-year-old son was looking after Anita's toddler while she worked.
I gave him my child. I was waiting for a long time.
When Anita went back to her little one, she says blood was dripping from her nappy.
He was pulling back the torn knickers on the child, and then I asked, what happened? He said the child has blood and poo.
Anita eventually took her child to the hospital.
The nurses began checking the child and they said, "Oh my God, what has this man done to this child? Even for an adult, it would hurt us if it happened to us." They took my child to the operating theater to stitch her up. The doctor who was treating my child even cried.
So this man, he raped up this young pikin.
Yes.
What is also worrying with that story is the fact that almost 11 months since the rape, the perpetrator is still at large and the woman is still crying and seeking for justice.
So Anita is what you're calling her. Still no hope of justice at the moment. But what happened to the sexual offences model court, which was introduced to fast-track justice for people like Anita?
So the police, especially the FSU that are in the front line in dealing with these offences. For example, I talked to the Assistant Superintendent Kanu, who heads up the FSU in this region. They are facing a lot of challenges that they are under-resourced, which really affect their movements. They don't have vehicles to move from one place to the other. So sometimes they say perpetrators can easily escape.
The reality is we have enough and good laws and policy, but the structure and personnel are the challenge for us to holistically address the issues of sexual and gender-based violence in Sierra Leone.
So we heard from Abubakar Bakar Kanu, who's the assistant superintendent of the Family Support Unit, the FSU.
And of course, the court is many years since it's found it was only in Freetown. Recently, they have branched it to another district in the country, which means districts and cities around the country like mine in Makini, sexual offense cases, still has to go to the high court for hearing. And what other people are thinking is that there is only one man, the Attorney General, who is only responsible to sign an indictment on sexual offenses. This, in sense, makes the process slow because you have to travel down to Freetown if you are not in Freetown to make sure the Attorney General signed this indictment and then before you can go to court. So people have their own way of thinking that we thought it could be faster with the sexual special model courts. But these are other flaws that people think it still brings delays in handling these cases.
What's the government's position? What are they saying?
Well, I talked to the Minister of Information, and this is what he has to say.
Clearly, we're not at where we were in the past. And when you talk to people as well, they feel that things are much better. Does that mean that we don't have the serious problem of sexual violence in Sierra Leone? Absolutely not. This is a deep-seated, entrenched, generational issue that's going to take a long, long time to solve.
And the minister there saying this is a deep-seated and entrenched generational issue that's going to take a long, long time to solve. I'm wondering, are people happy with this, with these explanations? Are they themselves, undertaking public awareness campaigns? Because punishment is not enough. You also need awareness campaigns for people to change their mindsets around these things.
Many Sierra Leoneans show frustration that after all the attention and the pronunciation of the state of emergency and the efforts that government seems to be doing towards fighting sexual and gender-based violence, people are still frustrated that 5 years on, 6 years on, we are still having this high number of cases every year and that the people who are set up to try and deal with this and not given the resources they needed to make sure they can work at full potential.
That's the Sierra Leonean journalist Tyson Conte in Makeni. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World.
Lives Less Ordinary brings you remarkable personal stories from across the globe, from people who've chased their dreams.
No one knew that I was going to travel by bike. If I had told them that I was riding a bike to Egypt, they might have said that it was impossible.
To people who've lived through nightmares.
Being in jail in Thailand, I made a promise to myself in that jail that when I'm home, I'm going to volunteer somewhere.
Life's Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Service. The Barbican Centre is a vast concrete building in the City of London. People live in it, there's a school there, a church forms part of the site, also a library, concert halls, movie theatres, a tropical indoor garden. Not everybody loves it though, because it's not pretty. But it does embody a powerful history. The structure was built and finished by a largely black workforce and was completed in 1982. It's one of the most important buildings to emerge from the post-war era in a London that had been bombed to bits by the German Air Force. To give this grey, brutalist icon a softer edge, the Ghanaian artist Ibrahim Mahama has covered its lakeside terrace with 2,000 square meters of pink, hand-woven, striped cotton. Stitched onto that cloth are 130 traditional Ghanaian smocks known as batakari. He called it purple hibiscus, a nod to the Nigerian novelist Chimamanda Adichie Ngozi's book. I went to the Barbican to meet Ibrahim to talk about his colossal installation.
I am walking along a lake in the middle of the city of London, but it's a lake in the middle of a concrete jungle, actually. So that's the sound you can hear in the back. It's the splashing water and the fountains of the lake. Next to me is Ibrahim Mahama, visual artist from Ghana. On one side of us is that lake, the noisy lake. On the other side of us, on the buildings that we see, this concrete building, huge concrete building. It's called the Barbican. And Ibrahim has festooned it with cloth from our continent. Ibrahim, describe to me what we're looking at.
You're looking at an installation which is literally made up of like batakaris, which have been collected, historical ones, from different communities across the northern belt of Ghana. It's been somehow superimposed on like the smock material which we commissioned weavers across the north to weave. Everything was done by hand. And then we formed a collective of women and men, and we stitched the entire material together in the Aliyu Muhammad Sports Complex Stadium in Tamale. And then we brought it to London to cover this brutalist building.
Explain what a batakari is.
So a batakari is a garment. It comes from the northern part of the country. Historically, I think it used to come from kingship. But then it's just an ordinary garment that people commission and wear. And it's quite important because it somehow, depending on the type and the design, it tells you where the person is coming from, the family lineage, or even in terms of the kingdom that the person is coming from, the history of the place, blah, blah, blah. And the reason why it's important is because most often it's not fast fashion. It is something that is commissioned, worn, and it's passed on from one generation to the other.
So it takes time and it takes attention and it takes resources because it's made of cotton, right?
Exactly. It's made of cotton. But these days, a lot of it is made of synthetic cotton because historically, the cotton that was produced locally is not produced anymore. So it's very rare to find the ones that are made of pure cotton. So if you want one, you have to commission the weavers and then you have to buy synthetic cotton threads and weave one for you.
What I find really interesting about these, right, is that they basically, right at the very top, there are some that what we know of as kente, but there are these beautiful cream ones over there. I have a cream one as well, a very heavy one, and that's got like a sackcloth on the inside.
Yeah, I think that's the most interesting part because so the sackcloth is used for the lining of the interior of the batakari in order to be able to absorb the sweat when you're wearing it. I think it's quite interesting because the sackcloth is from flour. And then when the flour is taken out of it, then it is sold to these guys and then they use it for the batakari. But I'm very much interested in the relationship between the sackcloth, the emptiness of it, the void that is left within it. That's the commodity that has been extracted from it. And then now it has been used to actually make a garment which now is worn over the body.
In fact, that brings us very neatly to your practice. And I think instead of us trying to fight with the sounds around us, because there are groups of people coming to watch your exhibition and also the lake on the one side, we'll walk inside and find a quieter place. So tell me, why do you wrap huge buildings with cloth, and specifically the kind of cloth that you use?
I started off in my practice by using jute sacks that I normally use for transporting cocoa in Ghana. And then subsequently after cocoa, they are used for transporting rice, maize, millet, and other things. The market women buy it, and then they use it to transport all kinds of things. The interesting thing is that when it's used to transport cocoa, because cocoa is one of the most valuable commodities in the world market, you can't use the bag more than once. So it's discarded, sold off. And then these market women, they use it to bag local produce like rice, maize, millet, and they tend to write their names and put all kinds of inscriptions on it. That's when I think the material begins to live, because then now you can begin to see all the paradoxes which are embedded within the history of this commodity, which is cocoa and everything else that is associated with it. I was thinking, what would happen if you collected all these discarded materials at the end of their, almost at the end of their life cycles, through a series of exchange, and then work together with a series of collaborators in the market, find different labor forms, put it together, and then envelope a structure. There's always, in buildings like one like the Barbican, when it was built after the Second World War, a lot of labor went into the building of it. Even you can see from the texture of the brutalist concrete, after it was cast, they had to chip off the surface in order to get the texture of the entire building. But whenever you think about the building, we never really think about the labor factor. We think about just the building in terms of who built, who designed it, the engineer, the architect.
But and what it looks like, rather than the people that actually put it together bit by bit.
Exactly. And that is what my work centers on, the idea of labor and how do we re-disseminate culture by, let's say, even using the precarity of labor as a starting point.
You name your installations according to the works of other famous African writers. So Purple Hibiscus is the name of a novel,
yes,
that Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie wrote, the Nigerian novelist. Mm. Why? Not specifically Purple Hibiscus, but why do you use that?
Yeah, why not? Because for me, it has always been, my work has always also dealt with the idea of resurrection. When I started working years ago, the reason why I collected these objects was because I thought that at a point when something is dying, that's when it actually produces more life. So each time that I produce a work, I want someone to be able to look at the work and look at it in relation to another author's work, even though it doesn't have any correlation, because the idea is that whatever we do in our generation has to be able to go back and preserve other memories in other generations.
And of course, I suppose we should remember that the times that we're talking about was the colonial era, so very possibly Ghanaian rag trade, yes, cloth and things came through here as well.
Even I hear that there was some kind of slave trade also that happened within the part of the site. So for me, I've always imagined that ghosts somehow dwell within spaces, within objects and materials. And I want to be able to summon those ghosts in order to be able to tell new stories.
What do you want people to take away when they look at not just this one year, but when they look at any of your installations?
So when people see it, I think it's just they should take a moment to reflect upon it. Why would an artist go around and collect batakaris that have been worn by farmers and other people, kings, and then with the sweat and sometimes urine and other things that are accumulated within it, put it on top of, let's say, a brutalist building in the center of London? I think that there are more important questions to ask within that. What does it signify? What does it mean? Not just in relation to history, but in relation to the present that we live in, in relation to all the multiple futures that can emerge out of it in terms of the relationships that we can create among ourselves.
I was going to avoid the urine question because I just think that it was fetishized by all the journalists that asked you that question. But now that you brought it up, tell me about it.
The urine question came up because I wanted them to understand how the process of acquiring these materials. Because you know that most of the spaces I'm collecting these from, they're mostly Islamic-dominated spaces, so in the north of Ghana. And when people are giving you an object, sometimes they believe that their soul is still attached to it. So in order to break the soul away from the body in terms of the past, present, and future, they feel like they have to desacralize it. Because even in Islam, when you go to the washroom and then there is urine on your clothes, you cannot pray with it. As an artist, I thought it was brilliant, actually. It's even more interesting when there's urine on it, because I was looking at the DNA through the sweat on it. And now you literally put human DNA into the material. So I thought that it was physically somehow charging even the material a lot more up. And also, I'm a painter, but I'm thinking about ways in which we can think about expanding painting with all that kinds of other materials. So if there's urine on a sackcloth, which is white, it means it's going to give it some yellowish tones and brownish tones. And for me, it's so beautiful.
So you've started an art scene in Tamale. Tell us about that.
I was born in Tamale in the late 80s, but I grew up in Accra. In 2014, when I was finishing my master's and I was thinking to build a studio, and one of my professors from the art school, Professor Karikacha, said to me, why not build it in the north? You know, like not many artists who emerge from the academy would want to live and practice there. Because one, you're looking for market for your work when you're practicing. But what you don't also have to forget is that when you're making work, the work has the ability to influence people around that community. So I said, okay, why not build a studio? So I started building the studio. And then later I realized that the kids in the community would come there to play. They would come there. They were curious about what was happening, that people would come. So I started looking at the possibility of expanding the space. And when I started expanding it, I realized that people, more and more people would come. Buses with school kids would come. And I realized that people were hungry for culture, you know, because in the city, when you wake up in the morning, there's nowhere to go. You know, there are no cultural institutions. Of course, the art center is there and all that, the cultural center. But you go there, it's for tourists. You go there to buy souvenirs and other things. So I thought that through my work, through this act of revival that I'm looking at, through the materials and everything, I could translate it into architecture. So the work can translate from a state of commodity, that is a work that is in museums, into a gift in the form of an architectural space that could allow us, for instance, a lot of works that I've done which are in museums all around the world, but as an artist, you can spend your whole life doing this kind of work, where every work that you produce, a museum will buy it and put it in the West. But then what you also don't have to forget is that there are kids in these local environments who will never get the chance to see these kinds of works, like purple hibiscus. So whilst I'm doing it here, we did it at the Tamale Sports Stadium for a reason, because we mobilized over 1,000 people in order to sew. And for me, even the act of sewing and producing this material in Ghana, one, it created employment, but secondly also, it engaged the people there in the work itself. So there are different ways of experiencing a work of art. It's not only when it's installed in London or in New York or other places, but also what happens in the local community, the artisanry. Like, does it influence the way people even think about how they produce things and how they experience it, most importantly, their children? So that's where the idea of the studio comes from. The idea that the artist studio is not just a place where he makes objects like a factory, but it's a place where collectively we all come together in order to be able to contemplate, to look at materials, to look at archives. So if you come to my studio, there are airplanes, there are trains, there are train lines. Yeah. So all those things, the idea is that can we as a younger generation build institutions that can allow for a new renaissance or a new age of revival within our cultural context that we find ourselves in?
I'm so pleased that I came to see you today and to see your work. Thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
Ibrahim Mahama, the artist from Ghana. Focus on Africa was put together by Rob Wilson, Nyasha Michelle and Patricia Whitehorn here in London. Paul Bachibinga was the senior journalist in charge of quality. Jonathan Greer was our technical producer, responsible for getting us on air and online on time. Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.
Lives Less Ordinary brings you remarkable personal stories from across the globe, from people who've chased their dreams.
No one knew that I was going to travel by bike. If I had told them that I was riding a bike to Egypt, they might have said that it was impossible.
To people who've lived through nightmares.
Being in jail in Thailand, I made a promise to myself in that jail that when I'm home, I'm going to volunteer somewhere.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.